It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show,
if the employer has done this, then all of these statutes have protection against retaliation if the person opposes the conduct. The employee goes to their employer and says, you know, this bothers me that I'm being treated differently because of my sex, or I'm being treated differently because of my age. And the employer says, you know what? I don't like that. You're being a little uppity, and you're fired. Then that person has protection of the law because they've been retaliated against simply for going to the employer and opposing discriminatory conduct.
Private attorney Harris Butler talks about what is and is not legally prohibited discrimination in employment and how lawyers prove and win these cases. And during this week's question and answer, we discuss when a landlord may require a tenant to pay a water and sewer bill and when it is the landlord's duty to do so. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 84, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR, 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. A little-known company with an odd name, the TALX, or Talks Corporation, has come to dominate a thriving industry, helping employers process and fight claims for unemployment benefits. Talks handles more than 30% of the nation's unemployment compensation claims by pledging to save employers money through contesting claims, because when fewer former workers get aid, a company pays lower unemployment taxes. Talks has become a boom business in a bust economy, but critics say the company has undermined a crucial safety net. Officials in a number of states have called Talks a chronic source of error and delay. Wisconsin and Iowa passed laws to curtail procedural abuses that officials said were common in cases handled by Talks. Connecticut fined Talks and demanded an end to baseless appeals. And officials with the New York State Department of Labor, without naming Talks, were so concerned last year about the credibility of agents that they warned staff members against taking the word of agents over the word of jobless workers and gave instructions that, in the absence of other evidence, decision makers should, quote, give greater weight to the claimant's statement, unquote. This standard also is the law in Virginia, but not uniformly applied. In other news, in at least one aspect of low-income housing, Virginia is the best in the country. In 2008, Congress authorized $1 billion in low-income housing tax credits. State housing finance agencies allocated $736 million for new construction and the remainder for acquisition and rehabilitation. This resulted in 54,000 new units and 28,000 rehabilitated units for a total of 82,000. But who benefits from the low-income housing tax credit depends on each state's policies and procedures. Many states target the program so that people at or below 30% of the average median income will live in these units, but each state decides how many units will go to people who are the poorest. Virginia led the nation with 73% of the low-income housing tax credit units being targeted for people with incomes at or below 30% of average median income. This was far above the national average of only 11%, and much higher than second place Vermont's 53% and third place Louisiana's 47%. More information about the program in Virginia is available at www.vhda.com and clicking on the Programs link. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegebright. You are listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for our new segment and the answer to our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? Last week we gave you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which was incorrect. Here's last week's question. Under Virginia's employment at will doctrine, you can be fired for any reason at all except a prohibited reason. Which two reasons are prohibited? A, because you were not born in the U.S., B, because you have a disability, or C, because you have children? The correct answers are A, because you were not born in the U.S., and B, because you have a disability. Discrimination based on national origin and based on disability both are illegal. Discrimination based on family status is not illegal, but asking in a job interview whether you have children is illegal. Later in the show, we'll give you this week's quiz. Is that legal? For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault.
It's time this week for the question and answer session. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
My name's Edward. I'm from Chesterfield County.
Welcome to the show, Edward. What question do we have this week?
I was just wondering if department complexes in Chesterfield County that I pay my water bill to, which is supplied by Chesterfield County, that basically, at the time I get the bill from the apartment complex, it's double what the county says it's supposed to be.
Now, Ed, let me ask you a few of the questions before I try to answer. Is the water included in your lease, or do you pay separately for that?
I pay separately for it to the apartment complex.
So I gather the bill is sent to the apartment complex, and the apartment complex adds on something to that bill and sends it to you, and you pay it?
Correct.
And one other question before I answer yours. Do you have a separate meter for your particular apartment unit?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Well, I was glad to hear that last answer because at least it shows that the whole setup is legal and complies with the Virginia Code. If the landlord bills separately for the water, then the landlord has to separately sub-meter your water as opposed to anybody else's water. And that's set forth in the Code of Virginia at Code of Virginia Section 55-226.2, dealing with not only water sub-metering, but also electric sub-metering, natural gas sub-metering, any other type of sub-metering. And this applies not only to apartment buildings, it applies to rooming houses, it applies to any type of rental housing in Virginia. So if the landlord's not going to include the utilities in the rent, but is going to bill you separately for them, then you have to have a separate sub-meter. And this gets violated all the time by landlords. Now, assuming there is a separate sub-meter, what do you have to pay? Well, that's set forth in the Code of Virginia, and I'm going to read the particular part of it that applies. It says, if energy sub-metering equipment, water and sewer sub-metering equipment, or a ratio billing system is used, the owner shall bill the tenant for electricity, natural gas, or water and sewer for the same billing period as the utility serving the building. And then it says, and this is what applies to you, the owner may charge and collect from the tenant additional service charges, including but not limited to monthly billing fees, account setup fees, or account move-out fees to cover the actual costs of administrative expenses and billing charged to the building owner by a third-party provider of such services, provided that such charges are agreed to by the building owner and the tenant in the rental agreement or lease. Now, that's a mouthful, so we'll break it down. First of all, you've got to look at your lease. Read it paragraph by paragraph, sentence by sentence, word for word. See what it is you agreed to pay. But secondly, regardless of what you agreed to pay, it has to cover only the actual costs of administrative expenses and billing that is actually charged to the building owner. So as you suggested, they shouldn't be making a profit on providing water to you. They should be passing through to you the actual costs for the water and sewer and the actual costs for those billing fees, setup fees, account maintenance fees, service charges that they actually pay. So you should be paying the landlord exactly what you would be paying the water company, no more and no less. And it sounds like that's not happening.
Thank you for your help. You explained a lot to me.
Okay, thanks a lot, Ed. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the law office of Butler, Williams & Skilling in Shaco Slip in Richmond, and we are talking with Harris Butler about the topic of employment discrimination. Welcome to the show, Harris.
Thank you.
Now, the first question that probably on everybody's mind is, what exactly is employment discrimination? A lot of people think discrimination means unfair treatment, but I gather in the world of employment discrimination, the meaning is a lot different.
It is. First, I think everybody needs to understand that in most states, and Virginia is like other states, the general rule is that employment is at will. If you don't have a written contract, either side can end employment. Your employer can fire you for any or no reason, and you can leave for any or no reason. You simply have to be given a reasonable amount of notice. There are certain laws that have been put into place, both in the state level and the federal level, that prohibit job treatment based on certain factors.
What are those factors?
So that would be things like discrimination or unfair treatment based on your gender, based on your race, your national origin, your religion, disability, age.
Now, if someone is being treated differently because of one of those protected statuses, what does the worker have to do? For example, do they have to complain to their boss? Do they have to seek some remedy with their employer? Or can they just up and leave?
The law says that your job really shouldn't be conditioned on this type of conduct. So an employee should never be placed in a position where they feel like they just have to give up and leave. Most of these laws that prohibit discrimination, that say that employer can't use those sex or race as a factor in employment decisions, and that could be how they pay people, how they promote, who they discharge or who they discipline. You can't use those factors as a basis. Not that it's the only reason, but it can't be in the mix. It can't be any of the factors. But if the employer has done this, then all of these statutes have protection against retaliation if the person opposes the conduct. The employee goes to their employer and says, you know, this bothers me that I'm being treated differently because of my sex, or I'm being treated differently because of my age. And the employer says, you know what? I don't like that. You're being a little uppity and you're fired. Then that person has protection of the law because they've been retaliated against simply for going to the employer and opposing discriminatory conduct. Now, the other thing they can do is they can go to a federal agency and file, if they work for an employer who has more than 15 or more employees, they can go to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and file a charge of discrimination. Now, they can do that themselves or they can get a lawyer to help them with that. And if they have filed a charge of discrimination with the EEOC, which is Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, then the EEOC will investigate and they will make a determination as to whether the law has been violated and will issue a decision.
Take a step-by-step through those EEOC procedures. I understand, first of all, there are certain time limits to file the complaint, and then there are certain time limits for EEOC to do or not do something, and then certain time limits for the complainant to do something after the EEOC has issued whatever it's going to issue. Take us through that process step by step.
You will file a charge of discrimination. You have an intake questionnaire you fill out when you get there, and then the EEOC will prepare. It's usually a one or two page document that's a summary. It's not every fact. It's just the overview of what happened, that you're a certain age, gender, race, or whatever, that you were discharged, let's say, under reasons, giving you reason to believe it was because of your age, sex, race, whatever. And, you know, the employer told me that whatever they told you, that I just wasn't doing a good enough job. But this other person who was not the same race, sex, national origin was doing the same job I was, and they weren't fired. So that's kind of what happens. The EEOC then investigates it. The claim has to be filed if you're a private sector employer, meaning you're not working for the state government or the federal government. It has to be filed within 300 days. It's about 10 months. 300 days of your first notice. So if they say you're going to be fired in 2 months, then that clock starts ticking when you're told you're going to be fired, not when you actually your last day of work. So it's important that you get it filed and don't wait. And if there's several things that have happened, let's say that you weren't promoted and then later you're demoted and later you're fired, and they happen 6 months apart. If you wait until you're fired, then you can only go back 300 days. So if you haven't filed a charge of discrimination when you were not promoted, and then the second time you weren't demoted, and that's both of those are before the 300 days, then you may lose those claims. So it's important that you either see a lawyer about those things or go yourself to the EEOC and file a complaint. The EEOC then will investigate. You know, they've been really severely understaffed. I think the Richmond EEOC used to have something like 8 to 10 investigators. I know during the Bush administration, they had been chopped back to about 4 investigators, and there wasn't a whole lot. They were just overloaded. And so there was a big backlog. But they're supposed to investigate and issue a decision that either there's cause to believe there's been discrimination, there's no cause to believe, or we just can't tell.
Now, if they issue a decision that there's cause to believe, I know the EEOC is empowered to take the matter to court. Do they ever? And if not, then what do they do?
Well, you know, they have very many things to look at. They have very many claims to investigate. And they rely on the private lawyers, the private bar, to take a lot of the cases. But they usually take cases where there's multiple complaints against the same employer, so it's kind of a systemic problem. Or if it's an industry that the EEOC is targeting or focusing on, a certain type of discrimination. Right now, it might be national origin discrimination. There was a big surge of Muslim discrimination, anti-Muslim discrimination, after the events of 9/11. So there's certain types of things that EEOC may focus on, but they're very, very selective, and they don't take a whole lot. Now, the thing that some people believe that's really not so is that, well, let's say EEOC doesn't find there's cause. What if the EEOC doesn't believe that there's something there? That doesn't mean that you don't have a case. We have been very successful with very many cases that EEOC, for whatever reason, because they only had 4 investigators, because they didn't put the time or have the resources to investigate, did not conclude that there was cause to believe there's discrimination. That doesn't mean you can't then go to court. After that letter is issued by EEOC, called a right to sue letter, then a person has 90 days to file suit in federal court. And if you don't file suit in federal court, you can't ever do it. Your claim is gone. But that letter of the EEOC usually will never be seen by the jury, won't see the light of day in the trial, because that may or may not have been investigated as well as the evidence would be presented in the lawsuit. So it doesn't foreclose you.
How do you prove employment discrimination? I imagine very rarely do you have an employer who says, I'm firing you because you're black, you're a woman, you're an older worker. It's just not that blatant and obvious. So how do you prove these cases?
Well, you're right. I mean, it's not a car wreck where, you know, in most automobile accidents, you know, somebody hit somebody from the side or behind, and it's pretty clear who had the right of way. In employment discrimination cases, nobody's ever going to come up and say, I'm firing you, or I'm not paying you as much because you're a woman or because you're a minority. or I'm firing you because you opposed the way that we're doing things and you're thinking we're not paying the women as much as we're paying the men. Nobody will say that. So there's three ways that you can that the courts accept as proof. One is what you alluded to, direct evidence. If there's evidence out of the employer's mouth or a written statement that says we can save a lot of money by paying the women less, then that's direct evidence, and that's evidence of intent. And in these types of cases, it's almost like doing brain surgery. You've got to get inside the head to see the motivation of the decision maker, the employer. They're rarely going to admit it. So what you do is you can get direct statements, direct evidence. That's rare. The most common way to do it is called circumstantial evidence, and that is if you look at the circumstances surrounding what happened, and you can infer from those circumstances that an illegal motive, sex bias, race bias, religious bias, was the reason, then that is sufficient evidence without any admission, without any direct evidence. There's a thing we tell juries about circumstantial evidence that I think is a good example. If we're in a room without windows and somebody comes into the room and they have an umbrella and there's a lot of water droplets on the umbrella and they shake it off and put it on the side, you didn't see the rain, you didn't feel the rain, but you see all those raindrops, you presume, on the umbrella. And so you infer it's good circumstantial evidence, strong circumstantial evidence that it has been raining and that those are raindrops. Okay, you're in the same room, person comes in with an umbrella, but only two or three drops on it. Now, that might be rain. That might be a window washer. It might be, you know, a fountain they passed by and got a couple of drops on it. So the fewer the raindrops, the less persuasive circumstantial evidence. And so we're always looking to find as many raindrops as we can find to piece that together. And the other forms of circumstantial evidence are if an employer's been acting a certain way for a certain period of time or acting towards a lot of people in a certain way and deviates in this one time, does something different, then that's evidence that it's a departure from how they would normally do things. And that's circumstantial evidence that a improper motive was at play, race or gender or national origin, something like that. The final way in class cases where we have a lot of people who are affected is statistical evidence. And in a lot of pay disparity cases where, you know, there's a lot of race and gender cases out there now, and there have been, where minorities and women have not been paid or promoted at the same rate as Caucasian males. And so in those cases where you have a sizable enough group of people, statistics can demonstrate, can be evidence that there has been discrimination.
So you've gotten your case together, you presented your proof, and let's say you've won. What remedies are available to workers who have been discriminated against?
In addition to the attorney's fees, compensatory and punitive damages, you can recover back pay and front pay. So you either get reinstatement. If you've been fired, you go back to work, and the judge says, you know, you have to take them back, and you can't treat them the same way anymore, and you can't punish them for having filed this lawsuit. Or the judge can say, you know, the blood is really a little too bad between these parties. I'm going to award all the back pay up to the time of trial, and I'm going to award a period of front pay into the future.
We have been speaking with Harris Butler, an attorney at the firm of Butler, Williams & Skilling in Chaco's Lip in Richmond. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Appreciate it.
It's time for our new segment, a weekly quiz called Is That Legal? We give you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which is incorrect, and we give the correct answers next week. If you're the first to email the two correct answers, we'll post your name on our show's website and send you a free copy of the Virginia State Bar's Handbook on your legal rights and responsibility. Here's this week's question. Under Virginia law, to get a fault-based divorce, your spouse must have done something wrong. Which two reasons allow for a fault-based divorce? A,
mental cruelty, B, desertion, or C, conviction of a felony and be in jail for more than a year? If you know the two correct answers, email them by Friday to marty@cvlas.org and be next week's winner. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. You and your attorney should be a team, but how are you to know what your attorney wants and needs from you? Join us next week when Palma Pastilnik, attorney with Central Virginia Legal Aid Society in Charlottesville, talks about how to work well with your lawyer in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on April 1, 2009. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.